Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome everybody to the show tonight. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a lovely guest lined up for you tonight. We have Ms. Barbara Houdekwee. She's an adult child entitlement syndrome is the author, the name of her new book, ACES, Adult Child Entitlement Syndrome. She's a master addiction counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist. Barbara, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, too. I want to listen to your story and get to know you a little better, and we're going to do that, I guess, right away. I like to get the backstory in some people, so if you could tell us some of your early memories of growing up, what was going on inside of you?
Sure. I'm one of four children. My parents are, they've been married for, 47, 48 years now. They had us all real close together, so the four of us kids were born in a five-year span. So we kind of grew up like almost like a tribe where the four of us were always together. And so there wasn't a whole lot of individuation. I don't know if that makes sense, but not really any one of us was given a whole lot of individual attention. We were just pretty much a group. So as far as forming relationships with my parents on a one-to-one basis, that really never happened. I kind of think that my brothers and my sister and myself, we kind of raised each other. Not that our parents didn't love us, not that our parents didn't love us dearly, but just the way things worked out, it really was kind of where we were one group and they were another group. So we grew up like that. As far as addiction goes and, issues pertaining to that, I think I had my first obsessive thought about food when I was about 6 years old. Our routine was we would go to we're Roman Catholic, and I would go to the 5 o'clock mass on Saturday night. And afterwards, our routine was we would go out to eat, and all through mass, I would be thinking about what I was going to order and what I was going to, where we were going to go, what I was going to eat, and all of those things. And I really clearly remember those obsessive thoughts, and they never really left me. Food was a big, big, big deal in my family, and pretty much every single one of us has issues with food and dieting and that sort of thing. None of us ever became obese, but we went up and down, up and down. And for me, that disordered eating cycle really took me out eventually. But that's kind of the longer version of my story.
Barbara, that's interesting that you definitely identified that. Maybe it's in the field you're in today that you looked inside of you or looked back like that. But that's interesting that you remember definitely 6 years old obsessing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, back then, I think there were a lot of diets coming down the pike, and my parents had every diet book under the sun, the Atkins diet, the Drinking Man's diet, the Stillman diet, the Weight Watchers, of course, TOPS, every diet book or program imaginable they were either looking into or had done or were planning to do. And so these diet books were all around the house, and I was an avid reader even as a very young kid. So I would pick these books up and I would devour them, no pun intended, but I would just swallow these books. I found it very, very interesting. And so I really kind of began being aware of calories and pounds and things like that when I was a third grader. I remember my friend Karen and I, we went to the school nurse, like all the kids did, to get weighed in the third grade. And I remembered it might have been the fourth grade, she weighed 77 pounds and I weighed 76 pounds. And I felt so superior to her, just really, really head and shoulders over her in every way because of that 1 pound difference. And, these are some of my very vivid memories. I had no alcohol available to me, but at that point, I mean, it was all about food. It was all about sugar, and it was all about weight loss at the exact same time. So
that's wild. I mean, I had no idea. I've never heard your story before. But that young and those feelings, that might segue into another question. Well, it's going to actually. How were you feeling about yourself? Can you talk about that? I mean, that Why do you know today why you needed to feel or the relationship with food? What were you looking for?
You know, I've heard a lot of addicts and alcoholics and of all, you know, addicts of all kinds, alcoholics, the eating disordered, gamblers, whatever, talk about this feeling that I'm going to describe to you now. So I know I'm not alone in this feeling, but I always felt that I was watching my life. I really never felt that I was in my life. I'd be with a group of people and we'd all be talking and I'd be observing myself talking. It didn't matter what I was doing. If I was on the playground, I was observing myself on the playground. I was simultaneously in the audience and in the picture. It was kind of a strange feeling. I don't know if you can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. I can. Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I was, what I was just going to say was that I was just very aware of myself all the time. I guess you'd say I was very, very self-centered, not necessarily selfish, but just very self-obsessed, obsessed about myself, obsessed about what was going to happen to me. I had a lot of anxiety as a kid, but I would overcompensate. As a matter of fact, to this day, no one believes that I'm shy because I have this persona of being very outgoing, you know, very dynamic and whatnot. But the truth of the matter is that I'm pretty shy. I just don't want anybody else to know I'm shy. So that's kind of the way that I've always moved through the world. And over the years, I've done the best I can to become more of my authentic self, you know, retaining those skills that I developed in terms of being outgoing and whatnot, but also having the freedom to be my authentic self in whatever situation I happen to be in.
Isn't it wild though? I mean, to identify that later on, you know, in life, and I guess it's all grace that we get to look back and kind of inventory that stuff. But the imprinting or however those thoughts came to you that you believe to be the truth, like you're not quite good enough or you're watching yourself, you always got to prove that, kind of always seeking approval. There's so many things in that. And that starts so young with this. And what I found, maybe you could relate to this, I don't know, but I kind of was asleep in my own life, kind of like you said, you know, and that's a crappy way to live when you realize that, I mean, for me, I woke up when I was 42 and thought, you know what? I've been watching it happen instead of living it. And you mentioned that. So how did
how did you start working through that? Well, just to back up a little bit, like I said, I was one of four kids and we were all, you know, really close in age. So my oldest brother, he was the first, I was the second, then I have a younger brother and a younger sister, but we were only 10 and a half months apart. So the competition between the two of us was very intense. I was always trying to, be like Bobby, you know, be as smart as Bobby, be as good as Bobby, be eat as much as Bobby, you know, whatever it happened to be. And so there was anytime I would get a compliment, anytime my brother would get a compliment, then that was my next goal, whatever it happened to be. I really felt that he was the front runner, and I didn't like that. I didn't like that. So I was forever competing from the time I was very, very young, but what I was competing for was compliments. That's what I wanted. I wanted approval. I wanted verbal approval. I wanted people to say that I was great, that I was good at something, that I was pretty or talented or smart or whatever the case may be. That was something that I really, really hungered for. And it certainly wasn't my brother's fault, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. It was just something in me. I noticed it. That was something that sounded good to me. I liked that. And I thought, I want that for myself. And it just was a hunger that never left me. And that's what wound up directing me into my first career as an actor and a singer.
That's funny you say that. I didn't know that, Barbara, but a lot of my previous guests, a lot of actors or people that are public speakers and in front of a lot of people, they all tell me they were very, very shy. I guess that's the way out of yourself and be somebody else or create something different.
So
you went through high school like that. It's a wonder you didn't act out in other ways. I know for me and other people that attention seeking, you know, manifests itself in some other destructive behaviors. Did you have a lot of that? Or
you know what, not that young. I was very afraid of disapproval, very, very afraid to draw too much negative attention to myself. I knew I had these thoughts. I knew I had these inclinations, but the consequence was the not enough. Like I said, I was Roman Catholic, you know, so I grew up in a very, very strict Catholic home. And, you know, to this day, we all love our faith tremendously. It's a huge part of my life, but you do have to be accountable as a Catholic. And there is a thing called confession. And it wasn't exactly my favorite thing to come in there and have to confess a bunch of stuff. But, as I got into high school, I don't want to say pressure, because it really wasn't pressure that made me want to start drinking or drastically under eating or whatever it was that I did, the self-destructive things that I did around food and with alcohol. It wasn't the pressure. It was wanting to feel a certain way. It was pressure from within. And it got to be too great, to where the consequences, they just weren't as important as they were when I was a lot younger. My freshman year, I think I was fairly on the straight and narrow, but once sophomore year rolled around, I was kind of off to the races, particularly with my eating disorder. And by the time I was a senior in high school, you know, I became I pretty much was a daily drinker at that point. I did my worst drinking in high school, which is interesting to me. You would think that it would have progressed, but in my case, after that, I realized I'm never going to get anywhere. And remember, approval was so important to me.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I was just like, I can't do this and get anywhere. I was real clear on that, even at 17, 18 years old. So I, you know, stopped drinking on a daily basis, but I still happened to be stuck with the binge drinking syndrome, and that didn't stop for many years.
It's funny. It's remarkable that you mentioned that. In some ways, I just got this sense, listening to you so far, Barbara, that in some ways that chronic seeking approval helped you in some ways, maybe. you know, in some kind of twisted way that served you okay for a minute there, because it got your attention about continuing on with other destructive behaviors.
Right, because I would hear people say things about alcoholics and drug addicts. That, you know, you hear the word loser tossed around a lot. You hear, you know, just whatever negative terms are used about people who struggle with addiction. And I just didn't want to be in that category. And so the binge drinking, that was something that I could always justify, because it would be around an occasion and everybody was getting drunk. I don't know if everybody was drinking themselves blind like I was, but everybody was drinking. So it was much easier to justify than drinking on a daily basis was, at least in my mind.
I feel that looking at that, some ways, again, seeking approval, that you could get approval in a group of people. You know, we seek out the people we're kind of like, or we become the people we're around most of the time, I believe. So did you seek that out? Maybe you just did some of the things just, again, to be accepted? Or
that's an interesting question, because in high school, I had two sets of friends. I had I had the set that were the goody-goody girls that got straight A's and didn't go out with boys and didn't go to parties and certainly didn't drink or do any of those things. And then I had the wild side friends, and I felt that I straddled the fence between those two worlds. I think my authentic self probably belonged on the goody-goody side, but but the curiosity was massive on the other side. And I didn't want to be on the outside looking in. I never wanted to not know. Whatever it was, I was very, very terrified for some reason of not knowing something, being caught not knowing what that was. And I never wanted to be perceived as a square or a dork or whatever that word was, whatever that descriptor is there that makes you not cool. Like, I definitely didn't want to be that. I wasn't comfortable with walking on the wild side over there, and I wasn't that wild. Let me clarify that, but I wasn't terribly comfortable over there, which is why drinking was absolutely critical, you know, in order to function in circles like that. And I think we call them lower companions. In order to travel in circles that way, I had to be pretty blitzed. I had to be loaded. Otherwise, it was just so incongruous. I felt so uncomfortable. I wouldn't have been able to survive.
Well, looking back at those years, Barbara, at that time, if you can identify it, was your heart ever tugging on you? Were you getting any kind of voice whispering in you, telling you that you should go this way and be an actress, or how did?
Oh, well, when I was in, from the time I was a little girl, from 4 years old, my parents used to get a kick out of me being able to, you know, recite television commercials by heart. You know, if you see them often enough, you could recite them. And I got a lot of praise for being so adorable, for, you know, being able to get up and sing a song and do those kinds of things. And so being an actress, being a singer, well, that was just, that was predestined for me because I loved the applause. That was just intoxicating to me. It was adrenaline and it was an addiction. So by the time I got to high school, you know, I was in all of the plays. The plays and musicals were pretty much selected with me in mind. I was definitely the star of my school, the star performer. And, you know, and so becoming an actress and a singer, that was just, I guess, what you would call a no-brainer for me. There wasn't anything else that I thought of doing. I never considered doing anything else. That was what I was going to be, and I was definitely going to be a big star. It was just a question of me getting in front of the right people, and it was only a matter of time. And, you know, one audition in New York City and I'd be catapulted to you know, the very, very top of the, you know, the top of the marquee in any Broadway theater. And it didn't work out that way. But I had enough success to keep me hanging on for quite a while. But no, considering any other line of work other than being a performer, that didn't come up for many, many years, not till recovery.
What kind of messages were you getting, either real or imagined, maybe in the home or from a guidance counselor or from other peers? Were they telling you, you can't do that, you'll go broke, you'll get hurt, or were they supportive?
Definitely my father. My father definitely did not want me to go into that line of work, and he was very discouraging. And for many years, I had a lot of anger and resentment about that because I was talented. I really was talented, and I didn't get any encouragement from him. And it literally was discouragement. Don't do it. You'll never make it. Like, those were some of the things that he said. Now, as a grown woman, I've come to understand that was not because he didn't think I was talented. It was because he didn't want me to get my face smashed in by a heartless business. And he knew how hard it was to make it in show business. He understood that. Not that he was in show business, but he knew that, you know, it's your chances are very similar to winning the lottery, the chances you would have at winning the lottery. And as far as it being a business of who you know, that's absolutely true. It absolutely is true. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anybody. So he just didn't want to see me get crushed. The way he went about it, I don't think that was the way to go, because what wound up happening was I think I stuck around in that business a lot longer than I might have had it not been for me wanting to prove to him that he was wrong. As far as everybody else goes, directors, friends, acting teachers and whatnot, all I got was encouragement. Go for it, go for it, go for it, go for it. You're going to be a big star. You're great. I mean, I traveled in pretty small ponds out here. There's not a lot of theater. I lived in Los Angeles. There's not a lot of theater out here that doesn't come from out of town. So if you are talented, you can work. You can work all through the state of California in theaters that no one's ever heard of outside of those towns. But I was able to work and get jobs. When I decided to go to New York, that's when reality, you know, really set in around the choices that I was making. And I was just very, very unhappy. I got mixed up with the wrong person and wound up in a 10-year relationship there. And just a lot of really, really crazy choices after I got to New York. That's when it really got bad.
Well, what was the, if you can pinpoint it for us or describe it, what was the underlying, I guess, motive for you going to New York, or what, how did those
decisions come about? Well, it's funny. It's kind of funny, actually. You know, in Southern California, if you don't have a car, you can't function at all. And my car was dying. My car was absolutely on its last legs. And I was doing I had a contract with a country rock band that was ending. And, what else? Let's see. I was done with college. I had dropped out of undergraduate school for 3 years and went back and finished. So that was done now. So college was done. My job was ending. My car was dead. And I was speaking to a friend of mine who lived in New York, and he said, why don't you come here? And a week later, I was on a plane with two suitcases and a credit card, and that's about it. You know, about $1,000 in cash savings, and I moved to New York, and it was kind of a why not decision. Yeah. I do feel that New York called me. I had a feeling I was going to wind up there eventually. The timeline though was weird. I was very, very thin at the time too. So I figured like, well, how many, you know, this might not last very long. So I better get there while I'm skinny. And
oh, that's wild. Oh, Barbara, I'm glad you laughed.
Oh yeah, it's funny. I think of my story now, and I do find it kind of amusing. But
so I mean, when you're there, that was huge for you. To I don't know what kind of counsel you sought. You just listened to your heart, or you had nothing to lose, maybe, like you said, or a combination of all those things. You must have trusted that person.
Well, I really didn't get a whole lot of counsel. My husband always jokes around with how I'll just kind of go for whatever it is, whatever my goal is, I just kind of go for it without really considering that I might not be successful. So I had that kind of terminal uniqueness where I thought all I need to do is get there. And then, my career will take care of itself because I'm so unbelievably talented, don't you know, that once I'm there, it's just a matter of time. That really is the truth. I'm not super proud to admit that because it's, you know, really kind of references the ego that I've battled. But it didn't occur to me. It really did not occur to me that I wouldn't be successful. It really didn't. That's the truth.
Okay. So what happened? I mean, how did that go?
Well, when I got there, I went to an audition the very day after I got to New York and got called back immediately. And then about a week after that, I went and auditioned for an off-Broadway show and got cast. So it was, kind of whatever it was I believed about myself, it was kind of happening because my friends were, gosh, I've been here 2 years and I haven't gotten a call back, or I've been living here for a year and I haven't even gone an audition yet, and already you've booked a show. So I would continuously get that feedback that I was different, that I was exceptional. The truth of the matter is though, the kinds of jobs I was getting weren't necessarily going to make me a star. I mean, it was a job in the chorus, and it really wasn't anything to speak of, but I was working and my peers weren't. So that was enough to make me feel superior. Mm-hmm. But right around that time too, after I moved to New York, I met someone and I got involved in a very serious relationship, and the two of us had all kinds of addictions in common, and we were really bonded together in those addictions. In fact, that was the glue. It was the sickest, most codependent relationship. You know, it really was. And it did last quite a while. It lasted 10 years. And, I really kind of lost my gusto. Not that he didn't want me to be successful and not that he didn't encourage me, because he did. It was just that I just didn't want to anymore. I just felt like I couldn't. I don't know how to explain that. Once I had that relationship, it was sort of like the steam went out of my sails. It's kind of hard to explain.
Well, okay, so for 10 years, that was I'm sure it did just happen one day, or maybe it did, but you kind of recognized, did you not, that the air was coming out of you as that was going on?
I did. And after a couple of years of being there, I really started to bottom out really bad, like really, really quickly. I used to get to this one weight where I would go on a diet and I would lose the 20 pounds and then I would gain it back and lose it, gain it back, lose it. So it was the same 20, sometimes 30 pounds that I would trade up and trade down. Well, after I got up to the weight where I would normally go on a diet, one day I just kept going. And that had never happened before. And I was more curious about it than even panicky. I got to this place where I was just like, so, and I didn't care. And that was really alarming. In retrospect, that should have been very, very alarming, but it was like I had no energy to fight it anymore, or alcohol. I really didn't have any energy to fight it at all anymore. I realized that I'd been holding my breath my entire life. And once I was in this relationship and he was able to support me, I just kind of lost all of my gumption. Anyway, after I got into recovery, that didn't last very long, though. That lasted about I don't know, 6 months to a year where I was just completely unproductive. And I did get into recovery. It was kind of an amazing story. I was out in a, I don't know, do you really want to hear this? Do you want to hear my moment of clarity story?
It sounds like it's a story that needs to be told now.
Well, we came out to California, and it was for Christmas and New Year's. And on New Year's Eve weekend, we drove up to a beautiful bed and breakfast in Santa Barbara. And I don't know if you've ever been to Santa Barbara, but it's one of the most beautiful places, I think, probably in the world. The scenery is just breathtaking. And we had been wine tasting all day long, and that was just a very sophisticated way for me to get drunk. And and so, you know, I felt terribly sophisticated as I was getting loaded. Anyway, we'd been drinking and eating all day because you're eating all this bread and cheese and fruit and this and that. By the time we got to the bed and breakfast, I was so ill. This is on New Year's Eve. I was so, so, so sick. And I was in the bathroom, and this person I was with was on the other side of the door listening to me die in there. I was just so ill, sweating profusely, you know, and thinking to myself, I don't want to die, but if I do die, that's fine. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like I wanted to kill myself or end my life, but if it did end, I would have been fine with that at that moment. That's how much pain I was in and how much emotional pain and spiritual pain that I was in, that I was driven to the point of making myself so ill that my compulsivity was so intense that I could not stop. I could not stop until I was completely very, very, very sick. And, anyway, when I finally did open the door, and I had no idea how long I'd been in there, it could have been 2 hours, it could have been four, I really didn't know. I opened the door, and I must have been white as a ghost. And, you know, the person I was with said to me, "Are you okay?" And I said, "What time is it?" And he said, "It's about 11:45. And I said, "Ooh, do you think if we hurried, we could make it down to the pub before midnight? Maybe we could still get a pitcher of beer and some cheeseburgers." I mean, that's the crazy, crazy way that my head was working back then. Well, the next day was New Year's Day, and I woke up, and, you know, I was still kind of a little bit queasy from the night before. Not terribly hungover, but just didn't really feel like eating and drinking or anything like reckless behavior at all. And we went out and we were sitting in this vineyard, and I remember it so vividly. I'll never forget it. I looked up into the sky, and it looked like the clouds had parted just for me, as if God had just kind of like pulled them open like a theater curtain. And so the clouds, it was just perfect blue right there, up there in the sky. And then I looked behind me, and there was the ocean. And I looked in front of me, and there's the mountains. And I'm standing in a vineyard, and I'm looking up in this crystal blue sky. And I knew in that moment that something had to change, that something was going to change. It really was a moment of clarity. It was sort of a spiritual awakening, you know, right then and there. And when I got back to New York, I went to my first 12-step meeting. And I remember sitting there in that room, and there was a man in that room, and he had to be about 75 or so, and I was in my late 20s. And I'm listening to this man, and he looks like he hasn't had a shower in a while, and he looks like he's pretty broke. And I'm like, how does this man know my story? You know, he's telling his story, and I'm sitting there thinking, this is my story. And what I realized was that the feelings that these people were sharing were the feelings that I'd had my entire life. And I just felt for the first time almost ever that I was home, that I was in a place that was very safe, that I was in a place where I understood what they were saying, and I strongly suspected they would understand what I was saying. And that was a comfort to me that to anybody who has not experienced that, I don't think I could explain it. But when I tell my story to people that have recovered through 12-step programs, they all seem to get it. So I knew I was in the right place, and I never stopped. I never stopped going, and that was going on 18 years ago.
Good for you, Barbara. That's so cool. I had no idea, by the way, and thank you for telling that story.
You're welcome.
I got to ask you a question, though.
Sure.
That at 11:45 on New Year's Eve, when you came out of the bathroom, did you end up going back to the pub for more breakfast?
Yeah, we did. Of course we did. Remember, I told you the guy that I was with was just as sick as I was.
I had to ask, because that sounds just about right. at the time.
Yeah.
That sounds perfectly right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, when I tell my story to other alcoholics and the eating disordered, they all seem to understand perfectly. That sounds logical. Well, you had 15 minutes to get there.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad to hear for you. And it's reaffirming and reassuring that when you sat down, you knew this is where you're supposed to be or whatever, however those words are, however you can describe it like you did. That's wonderful. So, well, what did you do then? I mean, how did those next years go and the marriage?
What happened was that, you know, once you stop eating bags and boxes of things, you do tend to drop weight pretty rapidly. And that's what I had been doing. I was eating bags and boxes of things. And so the weight fell off pretty rapidly and I was able to start going to auditions again. And so because that was all I knew to do, I didn't really have any other ideas about what I was going to do with myself professionally. I was kind of done tending bar and doing part-time jobs. I said, now it's time for me to really, really focus seriously on my career. You know, I'm in recovery now. I'm just going to be better. But what happened was as much as I was starting to wake up spiritually and get my emotional strength back and whatnot, it just became clearer and clearer with each passing month that I don't want to be here. This doesn't even do it for me like the way it used to. I would get a job and I'd be at rehearsal and I'd want to be somewhere else. I couldn't enjoy any of my success. I said, okay, well, I want to get into the Actors Equity Union. You know, I wanted to get into the Actors Union and then that happened and that was anticlimactic. Well, now I want to get an agent. So I got an agent. That was anticlimactic. Okay. I want to be on Broadway. So that happened. That meant nothing to me. Nothing meant anything. It was, everything ended up being just, meaningless. And I was sitting, with my therapist one day, cause just like here in California where you need a car to function, in New York City, you need a therapist to function. So everybody pretty much has one. So I was sitting there with my therapist and I said, Marilyn, I think I've outgrown show business. And she says, well, what would you do if you weren't in show business anymore? And I looked at her and I said, well, I think I could do what you do. Mm-hmm. And what would I have to do to become a therapist? Because I realized how much I enjoyed the therapeutic exchange. I just really enjoyed it. I liked going to therapy, regardless of what side of the room I was sitting on. To this day, still, I love the therapeutic exchange. I love being a therapist and I loved being a client. It was fine. I just really liked the exchange of ideas. I loved generating insight and experiencing insight. So she told me what I would need to do. She says, well, you're going to have to go back to school. You're going to have to get a graduate degree. You're going to have to do traineeships and internships. You're going to have to get licensed. You're going to have to do all these things. And as she was rattling off this list, I just kept thinking, I kept nodding and thinking, uh-huh. And I kept waiting for her to say something that was going to scare me off, but nothing did. It just sounded so awesome to be free of the compulsion to be a star, that I stopped running from that need to prove myself. You know, recovery does that for you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I made peace with my father's real intentions, wanting to protect me and save me from heartache. It wasn't to just say, I don't believe in you and I don't think you're talented and you'll never make it, to be mean. That was never what he was about, ever. And I came to realize that. So once that was behind me, I'm like, well, what am I doing then? You know, what am I trying to prove? I hate this. I'm sick of it. I wasn't enjoying it anymore. And I was talented. And I remember the last time I really enjoyed being in the business was when I wasn't getting paid. That's when it was fun. It was when I was in college and, you know, when I first got out of college, and that's when it was really fun, when I was making nothing, when I was making $100 a week doing regional theater in Timbuktu. That's when it was fun. And once you get to New York, you just turn into a walking resume, and I hated it. I just hated it. So we moved out to Los Angeles and I got into a good graduate school and I never looked back. I never did. I just loved it from my very first class. And I love what I do. I loved working with the chronically mentally ill. I did that in psychiatric hospitals. I worked in chemical dependency programs and ran a couple of programs there. And I just loved it. I got a chance to work with schizophrenics for a couple of years, which was so, so meaningful to me, more meaningful than anything I had ever done in show business. Being in a position to be an adult in the lives of these people who were so marginalized by society, being one of those privileged adults that got to treat them with dignity and respect. It meant so much to me. It really did. It meant so much to me. And I'm just so grateful, incredibly grateful for the way that, the turn that my career took. And I know that it wouldn't have if it hadn't been for recovery. I know for a fact that if it hadn't been for those 12 steps forcing me to, you know, take inventory and look at myself, I would never have come to the conclusion that I need to do something else with my life. And I've never been happier. It's the best thing I ever did.
I got to say, Barbara, I'm enjoying myself listening to your story, and a lot of it resonates with me. And this show isn't a recovery show, but it's a remarkable that a lot of guests come on and I learn a lot of things about, you know, a lot of things about people. It's wild how we're drawn together. Isn't there a, you described it kind of, that sense of freedom that comes over us when we finally have to stop proving ourselves to everybody or whatever it is that we're doing, you know, and live for what we want to do, our real desires. I can tell you, it sounds to me telling that story that all that disturbance you had not being fulfilled in what you were doing was good, actually. It kind of got your attention enough that you could kind of listen to your heart, right?
Well, it was. And, you know, hitting rock bottom is not the worst thing. When I'm working with clients who feel that they are just at the bottom of the pool, I say that's not a bad spot to be because, you know, if you're at the bottom, you can push yourself back up relatively quickly. It's when you jump into the pool where you don't feel the bottom that that it takes kind of a little bit longer to shoot back up to the top, and it takes a lot of effort. But when you hit the bottom like that, you can kind of push off, have something to push off of. So, yeah, I'm very grateful. I'm very, very grateful. I didn't have the kind of bottom that a lot of people have, where I wound up with DUIs and, you know, legal problems and, you know, the kinds of really horrible consequences. But the horrible consequence for me was I didn't like the way I was living. Right. I didn't like who I was. I'd lost my self-respect. I'd lost my dignity. And that was not acceptable to me. That's not the person I knew that God intended me to be anyway. Mm. So when I changed fields and started living that way for real and honoring myself and not trying to be somebody I wasn't, that's when my life really took off. That relationship that I had been in finally ended. And that was a real major move that was a long, long time coming. It was the right thing to do. And 11 months later, I married the love of my life, the absolute man of my dreams. And we have an incredible life. We have two amazing daughters and a home. And, you know, we both live a life of recovery, and he's got about the same amount of time in recovery as I have. And we're just so grateful. We're one of these couples that we can't go a day without counting our blessings, not just for our recovery, but for each other and for our healthy children and for a wonderful place to live. And, you know, moving through the world with that attitude of gratitude, it's the key to happiness. It really is. And I don't think I ever felt that way prior to allowing myself to be who I think I was really intended to be and do what I was intended to do.
Thank God for bottoms, right, Barbara?
What's that?
I said, thank God for bottoms.
Amen.
Bottoms, you know, it's hard to say it with compassion, telling a guy that's seemingly at his bottom that this is a great place to be. You know, it's up to me. It's up to me where we go from there. That disturbance and all those things, that how would I know that down the road that could be very valuable to other people, you know, my experience.
Absolutely.
And that's what the show's based on. We tell our stories hoping that our experience can benefit some other people. And I heard you say it, that you got excited about being able to help other people.
Definitely.
That's how I heard it. So
definitely.
How did that process go? Did you start your own counseling business? You said you were working in different.
Well, I got to take my hat off to the state of California, because the preparation is really exceptional. Before you can get licensed, you have to log an enormous number of hours working with different populations, the elderly, children, the chronically mentally ill, couples, entire families. You really do get a great sampling of different populations. You need to work with people of different cultures and whatnot. And when you go to school, even while you're in school, you're doing this work. They also put, you also have to be in therapy while you're going to graduate school so that you have the requisite empathy for the clients that you work with. After I graduated, I got a terrific internship, at a hospital in Rosemead, California, BHCL Hambra, and I had that opportunity to work in a lockdown unit, with the chronically mentally ill. And that was a real rude awakening for me in terms of what people go through who struggle with very severe chemical imbalances, and got to see it up close and personal, not just the in the form of a panhandler in front of a grocery store, but people who were just very ill, literally and clinically and diagnosably ill, and seeing them, being able to treat them, like I said, with respect and dignity. And I just felt very privileged. I had that opportunity. I also got to work in the drug and alcohol programs. That was a natural fit for me. And I worked in a group called Prop 13, where we work with people who are released from jail early. If they can stay sober, they get a break on the sentence that they've had. And I got to work with them, and they had some amazing stories. Talk about low bottoms. I mean, if you find yourself in jail for years at a time because of your drug and alcohol use, well, then you know you've hit a real bottom. So working with them, and like I said, it was just, everything was so meaningful. But after working several years in community mental health centers and psychiatric hospitals and whatnot, I did decide to go off into private practice. And although I don't work with the same populations, because it doesn't really make sense in a private practice, because I don't have the facilities really to work with the chronically mentally ill, at least not the ones that have psychotic illnesses. I don't really get to work with that population anymore, but I work with couples, and I work with families, and I work with individuals who struggle with all kinds of different mental and emotional problems. And it's very rewarding. It gets more rewarding over time. And I'm just very grateful to have found my way into this profession, to be honest with you. It's really great.
How about if, tell me, acted up at the beginning of the show, and I apologize, I was so focused on pronouncing your last name right that I kind of hacked up the book ACEs, Adult Child Entitlement Syndrome. What led up to you being qualified to write that, or what led up to you, the calling for you to do that?
Well, I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, so I do work with lots of couples, and I do work with entire families at times too, mostly with couples. And it just continued to pop up in my practice where they were older couples, 50s and, you know, late 50s, early 60s, where these particular couples would present with a startlingly similar symptom profile, where they would have an adult child living with them at home who was totally underproductive, and the problems in their marriages were very similar to each other. So I started to identify what I considered to be a syndrome. So I started talking with other colleagues. I said, do you see this? Are you seeing a lot of this? Oh my God, I'm seeing this constantly. And so I decided to identify the syndrome. I called it adult child entitlement syndrome. And adult children would be anybody that is 24 years of age or older who is living at home, financially and otherwise dependent on their parents, who don't seem to have the motivation to move forward in their lives. And then the parents seem to maintain a very entrenched belief that if they were to force their adult children out into the world to fend for themselves, that they simply would not survive. So they are overwhelmed with this feeling of guilt and fear, these feelings of guilt and fear. And they're not necessarily, they want their children to progress in life. They do, but they don't believe that they can. And unfortunately, that belief does trickle down to the adult children, and they live up to that. You know, they do. They live up to their parents' expectations, which at that point are pretty low. Their expectations for their children do become pretty low over time. Now the children, the adult children, have a very entrenched belief also, and that is that they are entitled to be cared for by their parents indefinitely. They're just just by their birthright, they are entitled to live in their parents' home, eat their parents' food, use their parents' utilities, and come and go as they please, by the way. No accountability to the parents, but that they should live rent-free. And the parents don't ask them for anything a lot of the times either. Mm-hmm. They seem to kind of co-sign this very irresponsible lifestyle. So on a conscious level, they're frustrated by it. And on a subconscious level, they really do undermine their adult child's ability to move forward. And that's the where the book gets kind of interesting, is that the syndrome really lies within the marital unit of the family. So there are certain characteristics in these marriages that allow the development of ACEs to occur. And one of them is a lack of intimacy within the marital unit. So what happens is that the adult child becomes triangulated in the relationship between the husband and the wife, to where they become dependent on that adult child to diffuse tension between the two of them. So they don't know this. Nobody really knows this is going on, but that is what's going on. And so the parents relate to each other through that adult child. They've grown apart over the years, and the thing that they do relate to, the thing that they do have in common is that adult child. So they find themselves locked into a perpetual parenting mode. I don't know. If you have any questions about the book, I'd be happy to answer them. I just don't want to go on and on too long without giving you a chance to ask any kind of questions about it.
You're doing good. I'm captivated. I want to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
Do you identify with those older parents? There's some control, or they get some self-worth out of having someone dependent on them, or have you looked at any of that? Does that make any sense?
Sure. It's not so much that they are getting a kick out of the control. It really comes down to fear of being alone, fear of being alone with their spouse. They've become so estranged over the years. And let me clarify that just because there isn't intimacy in a marriage, it doesn't mean that there isn't love. People can love each other very, 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 very deeply on a very profound level without being intimate at all. And without intimacy, there's tremendous tension. Tremendous tension can occur in those marital relationships. So they become dependent on that other person to be around to diffuse the tension. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see that I think probably everybody has a relationship in their life where if the television is on, it's cool. You know, you can sit there with the person for a long time, and and the television can be a great triangulator for people. You don't have to relate. People will eat their meals in front of the TV with their significant other, with their husband, their wife, their boyfriend, their girlfriend, and they do that on a routine basis because there's no intimacy required whatsoever. You know, sharing a meal is an intimate activity, but sharing a meal without the television on, but sharing a meal with the television on is not an intimate activity. Turn the TV off and it becomes an intimate activity, and that requires a lot of emotional energy, and a lot of people just don't have it. They don't want to go there.
It has to be really touchy for you to break the information to people that are seeking help, that, you know, they're hurting the adult child. They really are, correct? How do you just tell somebody that?
Well, the good news is this, is once the couple is able to accept that the syndrome trickles down from the dysfunction in the marriage, right, the anger towards the adult child seems to disperse. And they're able to make some changes. If it's their responsibility, well, then they are charged with certain aspects of the recovery process. Most of the recovery process is directed to the marital unit. Right. The byproduct of ACEs recovery is that the adult child is launched out into the world of personal responsibility. The relationships all get better as a result of that. It's a really comprehensive program of recovery. It's not just kick your kid out of the house. It's not a how to kick your kid out of the house book. It's basically how to have a healthy marital relationship, how to have appropriate relationships with your adult child where the parents are not friends with the adult child, but are able to have those maternal and paternal roles. We need our parents. We need our parents sure. into our adulthood. They're sources of wisdom and strength and guidance, and we want to be able to seek them out. We'll have lots and lots of friends over the course of our lifetimes, but most of us only have one father and one mother. Mm-hmm. And those roles really get clouded with the ACEs syndrome. It just, relationships become very difficult to differentiate. So part of the recovery process is helping everybody to assume their proper role within the family. And the adult child needs to survive, needs to be able to come to believe that they can take care of themselves, that they won't drown. They find their resourcefulness. They find that they are able to be resourceful when they have to be. But when they don't have to be, they won't. And that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, that makes sense. So a lot of times the adult children don't go willingly, but they all come to be grateful for the head, you know, for the boost that their parents give them by, you know, pushing them forward in their lives.
We're in a supportive role, and you have that covered. As I'm listening to you, I'm imagining the best that I can, trying to relate. It must be challenging for someone almost not to, I guess the word is to relapse. Like, say the adult child is out on his own and the car breaks down. You know, how, mm-hmm. it must be hard for when those phone calls come. Do you give them tools to work on that, how they can sort out?
Yeah, there's
experience?
There's a chapter in the book devoted to relapse prevention, mm-hmm. and because they're very common, pitfalls, very common triggers for relapse, and financial problems is probably the biggest one. Mm-hmm. So the adult children have to have a lot of contingency plans in place. The parents have to have a plan for how they're going to react to those kinds of mayday calls. Basically, if you didn't have those parents at home with that checkbook or those credit cards, you would have to figure out a way to get your car fixed. You just would. Mm-hmm. If you had to, you would. And so the book is basically trying to give parents permission to do the right thing by way of allowing their children to become adults.
Mm-hmm. What about, let's say, the adult child who has learned, which I guess most of us do, that playing one parent against the other, there almost has to be a pact from the recovering parents, correct? Like a real pact.
Right.
We're going to stay in this together no matter what. Again, probably the sense of willingness to change, to realize that they want to be different. They have to stay together, though.
That's right. It's a 12-step, ironically, it's a 12-step recovery process that I outline in my book. And the book is divided into two sections. And the first half of the book outlines the syndrome, the characteristics, and all the rest of it that outline the syndrome. The second half is devoted to the recovery process. And chapter one, it lays it out in 12 steps. And the first step is what you're referencing right here. The first step is for the parents to be on the same page. They have to be in full agreement. This is what we want to do. We believe this is for the best. And we are completely committed to this process. We're going to see this through. And that's not necessarily a snap decision, because you're right. Sometimes one parent has aligned with the adult child against the other parent. A lot of times it switches back and forth. There's a lot of dysfunction in families that develop ACEs. That's why any of your listeners that are interested, they really should go to my website and download the introduction. The introduction to my book is free. You can get it on BarbaraJPublications.com. You can download that and read the introduction. See what you think. See if you identify. And because all of the different chapters in the book speak to some of the things that you're asking me about right now.
Mm-hmm. And again, what's the website? Mention again, Barbara, please.
It's BarbaraJPublications.com.
Very good. And from there, they can navigate around to anything else on how to contact you as well. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I'm available for speaking engagements and whatnot. You can book that there on my website. There's the homepage has, what a website is. You know, they can definitely scroll around and browse the website, but the publications page will allow them to buy the book directly from my website. It's available in paperback, hardback. You can even get it as an ebook, but it's a very, very topical book, and the people that have read it, I'm very excited and very encouraged by the reaction that we've been getting about the book. And it really is, word of mouth alone is really allowing it to do very well already, and it just came out in December. So
good.
I'm very excited, very encouraged about it.
Absolutely, and that's why I wanted to ask you how long it's been out. So it's good to hear that it is doing well, and I'm sure it's going to continue to do well. This touches probably a little bit of every family in some aspect or another. So
yeah, it really does, and it's tough out there. I mean, you know, it's not untrue that the economy is tough, and that you know, even college grads are having a hard time finding jobs. And but this book is directed not necessarily to college grads who have worked very hard to get their degrees and whatnot. This is really more about the underproductive adult child who maybe dropped out of college or stops and starts a number of training programs, or maybe has an addiction of their own and they're not willing to get treatment for it. They might have legal problems as a result of their drinking or whatever. They may have been having children without being married and living at home with those children.
Sure.
These are the adult children that are not progressing in life. They're either unemployed or they're underemployed. They're still financially dependent on their parents. A lot of these people, say 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33 years old, living at home with their parents paying for their cell phone, or their parents giving them gas mileage, or they're still on their parents' car insurance policies and things like that. And that basically, those kinds of things that the parents are co-signing, those are the things that actually keep the adult child living at home, keep the adult child from progressing in life. That's the kind of thing that really has to stop.
Well, I'm glad you cleared that up. I mean, I'm certain you're not saying in the book or in your practice that anybody ends up at home in their mid-20s or 30s for whatever reason is like somehow some bad person. You described it. It's the people. Really, what it sounds like to me is just the takers. You know, we're just not really living in reality. We're not.
Absolutely. Oh, of course. Yeah, I have actually one of my clients is a medical student, and she's, you know, in her mid-20s, you know, she's completely financially dependent on her parents, but she's in medical school.
Absolutely. You know,
she's sure. Definitely got a goal. She's definitely moving forward. And as long as she's able to recognize that what her parents are doing for her is an incredible gift, giving her this opportunity, well, then she won't grow up with an attitude of entitlement. There's a lot of sacrifices involved in being a medical student. I mean, it wouldn't apply to someone like that. It wouldn't even apply to someone who was working full time and paying reasonable rent to their parents.
Sure.
I mean, you can't get an apartment for, I mean, less than a one bedroom apartment around here for less than $1,200 a month. I mean, live in Southern California. I mean, if you're paying your parents $1,200 a month to live in their home, I wouldn't consider you an ACEs adult child, you know, because you're really contributing to the household. I don't know why you would want to live at home if you didn't have to, if you could afford to pay your way in the world. I don't know why you would make that choice, but that wouldn't apply to someone like that.
Right.
It's for the people that are underproductive for without any kind of justification whatsoever. So the book does outline the co-occurring disorders like major depression or severe anxiety disorders, things that complicate the launching process. And those things do need to be addressed before a family would be successful in launching an adult child into the world and maintaining that. So you really do have to read the book in its entirety to fully understand the syndrome and to understand the recovery process. But like I said, if your listeners wanted to go to my website, they could download the introduction for free, and it would probably clarify the book and what it's about even better than I could really in this forum. So,
well, Barbara, you did a heck of a job clearing it up for me. And I was really captivated by listening to the whole story and not just the latter part of the ACEs situation. I really am grateful you've been on the show. It's funny how our paths cross, and I'm grateful for that. And also, I'm imagining that if people are listening to your story and they're even interested at all in ACEs, adult child entitlement syndrome, chances are there's a reason why got their attention. So, you know, people that maybe don't have any of that in their lives won't really even notice. So I believe the book, I'm sure the book is going to be able to help a lot of people that it hasn't helped already. So I think it's going to be a wonderful success.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that, Todd. I really do. And I will keep you posted.
And I'm going to keep, keep posted myself too. So, okay, Barbara, I want to keep following up and seeing how that's going. Okay. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. I mean, I really, really appreciate it. Your show is marvelous. You're a wonderful guest.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. And,
we'll keep in touch. I want to point something out. Early in the show, you said you were very talented. You said I was talented. Well, I believe that you are talented. Okay, that was his past tense, though. Okay.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. What a nice thing to say. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate that very much.
Barbara, thank you. It's been my pleasure. It really has been. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd. Good night.
Have a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.